Thank you for tuning in to the MMA Podcast, a special Christmas edition. It's December 23rd, 2016, joined by, of course, Sweet Pappy Jones on the other side of the U.S. Pat, what's going on, dude?
Oh, Jake, we're just hanging out. It is a lovely, lovely day over here. Still the 22nd over here on the West Coast. Been a little rainy. Rainy over here in the Southwest region, but it's been a beautiful time, and looking forward to breaking down both the UFC on Fox 22 action from last weekend, as well as not this weekend's action. We don't have any fights on Christmas, thankfully, I suppose, but the New Year's Eve weekend's UFC 207, we'll get a little detailed into that, so
looking forward to it.
Oh, man. Looking forward to getting into it with you, bro.
Yeah, I figured there's not really going to be much going on next week as far as news goes. You know, we're all going to be doing the holiday thing. So instead of doing a show next week where all we do is preview UFC 207, figure we'll go ahead and do that on this episode. And then next episode will be after UFC 207, first episode of 2017. Not only will we be recapping UFC 207, but we will be doing, of course, the fourth or fifth annual TMP Awards, where we give out our Fight of the Year, Knockout of the Year, Card of the Year, all sorts of good stuff. Tweet us if you have thoughts for different awards to give out. Tweet us, and we'll definitely be receptive to any creative ideas there. But yeah, this should be the last podcast of 2016. Then we'll be going into 2017, our fifth year doing it. We were going back to June 2012. 192 episodes, and damn, time has really, really flown. You know, I was going back looking at what was going on when we started the show in June 2012, and I think it was the Tough Live finale, so that Tough season where Faber and Cruz hosted that. That was going on, a bunch of other stuff.
Oh, that was a fun season.
We have come a long way since. But yeah, let's get straight into it, I guess. Coming up with UFC on Fox 22. That was this past Saturday, December 17th, at the Golden One Center in Sacramento, California. The swan song, of course, for eventual UFC Hall of Famer. I'm not sure if he is or not already, but a true legend of the sport, Uriah Faber. This was his final fight against Brad Pickett before he hung up the gloves. We had a lot of fun fights on the prelims too, so I wanted to get into those. Lots of decisions. Of the nine fights, only two of them were finished. Eddie Wineland's TKO over Takeya Mizugaki, which was an incredible combo if you didn't see it. And the final prelim there, a light heavyweight fight between Paul Craig and Luis Henrique da Silva. Cole Miller loses a very one-sided fight to Mizuto Hirota. Colby Covington and Brian Barberena, even though it was one-sided, 30-27 across the board, that was a fun fight. Other winners via decision, Sultan Aliyev, Hector Sandoval, Leslie Smith, Josh Emmett, and Alex Moreno, who defeated James Muntasri. You know, I guess the two obvious standouts were the finishes. It was a bit boring, but a lot of the decisions went back and forth, which was fun at least. But man, a couple of them dragged on.
Yeah, a few of them really did, and it gets kind of tough. Even when you do have, and I'd say the majority of the fights were good, they were exciting. But, you know, when you have 9 of 11 of them go to a decision, just the sheer amount of time that it takes up. And after a certain point, man, just about every single fight, like, after it gets outside of the first round, you're like, okay, we're going 15 here. And sure enough, that is what you got. The majority, I think it was what, like 10, 10 out of 11 overall, or how many? I don't even know what the final.
It was a long.
The
card.
Final
it was
decision
like,
count. It was.
It was like 6.5 hours of. You know, if you watched it from start to end, you're spending pretty much your entire day watching this shit.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Which, you know, I guess it's kind of one of those damned if you do, damned if you don't situations, because if they're not all decisions, then they're quick finishes, and then you're just filled with 4 hours of the same commercials and, you know, 2 hours of fights. So what are you going to do? It's one of those grass is always greener situations. But no, there were a lot of good fights. Just, you know, you really have to have the Starbucks or something on hand ready to keep you going through it. There was the occasional good finish in there, as you mentioned, Eddie Wineland, TKO and Takeo Mizugaki. Definitely, you know what, I liked the kind of had a lot of the old school WEC vibe going. I mean, just, I don't know if it was just the matchups, Wineland versus Mizugaki, and you know, Uriah Faber versus Brad Pickett. I mean, my goodness, I can't believe that those guys hadn't faced off before. Seeing Cole Miller in there, just lots of throwback names on this card. It was entertaining for that fact. Yeah, it was the pacing was a little tough, but entertaining overall. Really, if you go back and watch it fight for fight, it was a solid night for sure.
And that brought us to the main card that started off with Mike Perry and Alan Joban. You got the hard-hitting Mike Perry taking on his toughest opponent to date yet in Joban. you know, Perry looked really fierce early. You know, just was how we all expected him to fight, fighting aggressive as hell. But not only did Alan stand his ground, he was throwing some slick, just straight down the middle counters. He landed a couple straight lefts in the first round, used kicks more effectively than Mike Perry. I scored it 30-27. Looking at the card, how they judged it in the arena. Sorry, I got a little lost there. Yeah, the judges also saw it 30-27, 30-27, 29-28, another unanimous decision, of which we had a lot on the card. We had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 unanimous decisions and one split. Pretty one-sided fight. Perry said he wanted a rematch after, but I don't know really how you could justify that because, you know, Perry didn't look off his game, so to speak. He was working the same game plan he works in all of his other fights, and Alan game planned very well for it, and just, you know, really looked unmistakably the better fighter. The Southpaw Joban, his record now, is he coming off of? No, he's now got 3 wins in a row, so I'm interested to see who they match him up against next at 170. What did you think of Platinum Mike Perry against Joban?
Well, that fight I certainly enjoyed. Joban, he's a class competitor. Really the antithesis of Mike Perry on as far as appearance in the media, I guess you would say. Mike Perry could be rather crass, as it were. And Alan Joban, you know, I like him. He's an articulate guy. He's well spoken on the mic. He's not really the most braggadocious. He's not a Conor McGregor type, or, you know, I mean, Mike Perry is just vulgar to a degree beyond, you know, I would say a braggadociousness that Conor McGregor has. But I like seeing Alan Joban get that win. Plus, he's a creative fighter. He's won 5 of his last 6. As you mentioned, this is 3 in a row for him. Typically, he gets the finish, too. He really gets the finish more often than not. So I certainly I like what he does. I know that he was calling for some ranked competition. He, in a post-fight interview, I believe it was post-fight media scrum, he was saying he wants to break into the top 15, and he was kind of slighted that he wasn't ranked. So be interesting to see who he gets in 2017. I mean, heck, you go 3-0 in the calendar year and do so impressively more often than not. You'd think he's going to move on up in the rankings and get some bigger competition here.
Yeah, you know, I think the winner either way probably would have gotten a big step up because, you know, Gall, I'm thinking a couple fights ahead here. Perry had been talking so much. You would think either guy would have gotten a big step up with a win, and it was Joe Bann who came away with one. Moving along the next fight, Uriah Faber, who, man, my biggest gripe with this entire card, this is Uriah Faber's last fight of his career. And you're gonna make the co-main of this shit, Mickey Gall versus Sage Northcutt? You're going to put Mickey Gall versus Sage Northcutt above Uriah Faber versus Brad Pickett in the card order?
What?
Are you fucking kidding me? Like, you're not going to give Uriah the co-main in his last fight ever because Mickey Gall versus Sage Northcutt is taking the co-main spot? That rubbed me the wrong way. I thought there was no way in hell that they were going to do that, even though that's how it was listed on Wikipedia and all that. But nope, Gall Northcutt get the co-main. So aside from that, aside from all, just all my griping, I don't know. I thought that was
ludicrous.
I hope it was an oversight. Because if it was not an oversight and it was some sort of jab at Faber, that's just super shitty. But I don't see why you would need any reason to jab at Faber because he's been nothing but a company guy. That aside, Faber absolutely dominated Pickett. It was 30-26 across the board. That was the correct score. The first round was a 10-8 after Faber dropped Pickett, nearly choked him out. Like, really the only thing you can give Brad Pickett credit for here was escaping numerous chokes, surviving on the bottom, because all we really saw was Faber dominating on the feet and constantly just ducking a punch, grabbing Pickett and slamming him down on the mat and dominating him from the top. Pickett landed a couple strikes here and there from the bottom, but wasn't as close to his to the punishment that Uriah Faber was landing on top multiple times. Came close to finishing the fight. Didn't quite finish it, but obviously deserved the 30-26. Faber's last fight. It would have been fun to see a choke. Hats off to Pickett for, you know, looking resilient as fuck in there. But yeah, good final fight for Uriah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, really, this fight, I felt kind of bad that it was Brad Pickett, because I mean, let's be honest, Brad Pickett, man, that could have been his retirement fight too. I'd like to see Brad Pickett get one last fight in the O2, you know, maybe against the up and comer. He has a shot against, not saying he didn't have a shot against Uriah Faber, but I mean, realistically, both of these guys are at the end of their careers. Uriah Faber, though, more so just because he is calling it to be that way. Uriah Faber went out as the number 7 ranked bantamweight in the world. And who knows what he could have done at 145. The only reason he was fighting at 135 was because he was beating absolutely everybody at 145 except for whoever had the title. I mean, Uriah really has been a pound-for-pound great. And still, you know, in spite of finally losing in non-title fights for the first, you know, one or two times in his career in the last couple of years, I mean, still very sharp, still a top contender. I mean, as you mentioned, Jake, it was a thorough thumping of Brad Pickett on Uriah's part. Good hands dropping him. But really, even watching that fight, Uriah himself, he was looking a little bit slower. I mean, he's 37. I want to say Pickett was 38. You know, these are not the same guys that we were watching in the WEC 10, 11 years ago. And Uriah Faber, even though he hasn't had that much damage to these endured, he's still been a professional fighter for, you know, who knows what, 10, 15 years now. He's certainly taken his licks inside and outside the octagon. But he looked good in his fight over Brad Pickett. He really got to display his full arsenal and where he is good everywhere. And, you know, hey, Brad Pickett himself, I mean, he's no slouch. He's a guy that, you know, himself had great hands, great wrestling. He did, as you mentioned, Jake, he reached out and touched Uriah Faber a couple times. But, you know, I mean, that's going to happen over the course of a 15-round fight, I guess, or a 15-minute fight. It was really just Uriah from start to finish. And, yeah, it was certainly a solid performance from him, a good reminder of, you know, how good he is everywhere. Hopefully old Brad can get a similar send-off when it's his time in his hometown.
Yeah, and you mentioned that mark from Faber. You know, that's a wild record. Only lost two fights his entire career that were non-title fights. One to Frankie Edgar, who is a legend, one of the best fighters ever, and Jimmy Rivera, who, don't look now, he's 20-1, creeping up the bantamweight division, probably going to pound a hole in Brian Caraway's skull come January 15th at UFC Fight Night 103. Look out for that guy. Moving up to the co-main event, Mickey Gall versus Sage Northcutt. I don't know what to say about this fight other than, I mean, it was what I think most of us expected, just like the other Mickey Gall fight, you know. Northcutt had some decent striking, but Gall was obviously the bigger guy. Northcutt was moving up to fight him. There was a weird moment in the first round where, man, I forget what exactly happened, but Gall was on his back and Northcutt was standing, and he pulled some heel move. I forget exactly what happened, but Gall won the first round and ended up getting the rear naked choke a minute 40 into the second round. Do you remember the moment I'm talking about? It's fuzzy. I forget what exactly happened, but I was like, oh shit, this is a legit heel move by Sage Northcutt. What did you think of the fight?
You know what? I'm wondering if that was the second round. I'm trying to think. There certainly was a moment. I'm recalling that as well. At one point in the fight, at least the one that comes to my mind was, I want to say Sage was having some success on the hands. He did hurt Mickey a couple times in that fight. I mean, well, at least I want to say he dropped him the one time, I believe, busted him open, nice little laceration over his right eye. And while he was on the ground, I want to say Sage was kicking him fairly forcefully in the legs and talking a little bit of trash, telling him to get up, this, that, and the other. And seemed to be goading Mickey a little bit, trying to get him to throw them hands. I think, I don't know if that's the same moment you're thinking of, but I definitely got a little bit of that. And
all right, I'm watching it, and yes, this is the moment I'm thinking of. Sage postures up, stands up, walks out. Gall's still on his back, and then he waves him up and says, "Fight!" Drops a hammer fist, says. Says stand up, leg kick, stand up, leg kick, and like has his hands out like Nick Diaz, which is, this is with a minute 45 left in the first round, and Gall stands up laughing at Sage pulling a Nick Diaz-esque move. It was awesome.
Yeah, no, it was good seeing Sage emote, and Hey, it was. I mean, I must say, I thought it was going to be a little bit closer, but then come weigh-in day, you know, I did not realize that Mickey Gall was just that much bigger than
Big
Sage.
Guy,
I
yeah.
mean, yeah, big guy, 6'2", fighting at 170. I mean, Sage himself, not a small guy, 6 foot. But he was fighting at 155, and I said, gosh, good on him to move up and take that fight, because, I mean, certainly in the octagon, too, Mickey Gall definitely looked a full weight class bigger than Sage Northcutt in there. That's just a tough mountain to climb. I mean, both young, tough prospects. Yeah, it was a good fight. I thought Sage was going to win that one, but then once I saw the size discrepancy, I don't know. I started to believe, and yeah, Mickey Gall getting it done with the second round choke there. Like you mentioned, he had some good first round success, but got it done in the second with that rear naked choke. And Mickey Gall, 4 professional fights, 4 victories by rear naked choke. He's another Gracie Jiu-Jitsu guy. He was repping Jersey pretty hard out there. The California crowd was really booing the hell out of him in his post-fight speech in the octagon there. But I mean, man, you can't hate on that performance. He's been finishing people every time he's been in the octagon. So yeah, can't hate on that. It'll be interesting to see where he goes next. I don't even remember who he was calling out after that fight.
Dan Hardy.
Dan Hardy. That's right. That's right. Yeah, I don't know.
What
do you
think?
Think
about a match now? If Hardy can come out of retirement, sure, because I think that would actually be a test. You know, I don't think there's much of a test to beating two of the worst fighters in the UFC. You know, you have the worst fighter in the UFC in CM Punk and a bottom tier lightweight that has moved up to 170 to fight you. I mean, I don't really see those as big challenges if we're being realistic. Hardy would be a challenge. I'd like to see him fight a middle of the line welterweight. I want to see him actually get tested, because both of these kind of had a circus feel to them, Sage and Punk.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, and let's not forget the fight before Punk was he fought
Mike Jackson.
Yeah, Mike Jackson, who has literally the same or had the same amount of experience and credentials going into that fight as us. Absolutely no professional fights, and actually got to give him props, because he's an accredited member of the media that got access to the UFC. We're
still and a friend of Allen's too, actually.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. God bless. God bless. So yeah, I mean, he was 1-0 making his debut. Fought a guy who was 0-0. Fought another guy who was 0-0. You know, Sage Northcutt really is his first big test, and I wasn't even sure how he would do against that. But you know, he dropped Sage. That was what led to the rear naked choke. He was able to use that reach and get it out, put some hands on him, and you know, so can't hate there. That was really his first test. But as you mentioned, this is a guy who is what, unranked at lightweight, who was 0-1 at 170 pounds in the UFC. I want to say that was his fight against Barbarina. Was it 170 pounds? Sage Northcutt, I believe that was. So yeah, even there, in his most impressive victory, still, you know, you beat a guy who should probably be a weight class lower than you.
Let me see here. Yeah, that brings us to our main event, which the co-main was a bit one-sided, but I think a lot of people expected that. I think most people expected a back-and-forth fight here. The odds were just about even between Paige VanZant and Michelle Waterson. And you know what? I don't know if this was just a case of Paige having a bad day or Waterson actually being that much better a fighter, but Michelle took it to her and seemed like 100 times better the fighter. I mean, just, you know, was landing a bunch more, threw her down most of the fight. I mean, it went quick from Michelle landing to Michelle owning the clinch to her throwing Paige down. And Paige sort of trying to fight off Michelle on the ground until 3 minutes in, when Michelle literally choked Paige cold, and when she was not responding to the ref, was pulled off and judged the winner via technical submission. Awesome choke. Michelle Waterson looked great. You know, I definitely don't think it's time to give her a fight against Joanna next or anything. Definitely give her some matches against, you know, a Thug Rose maybe. I don't know. But, yeah, it was definitely an impressive performance from someone in Michelle Waterson that we've seen a lot of in Invicta, but not in the UFC. And she looked great. You know, I think she was the former 105 champ in Invicta. Moving to 115 to fight in the big show, and looked great.
Yeah, she really did. It was really Michelle Waterson from the beginning of that fight. She came out, was throwing the sidekick to keep range, and it just seemed like Paige was kind of reacting and just trying to play catch up and adjusting to Michelle from the outcome. She, you know, saw the techniques that she was throwing in, and I mean, I have to give Paige VanZant credit. I mean, she was at least, you know, mimicking, and she was, you know, adapting, trying to learn on the fly. She started, you know, replying with some of her own sidekicks and things like that. She was trying to keep the range well herself, but, you know, when you're just kind of trying it on the fly versus someone who, you know, has this technique down pat as a part of their muscle memory, and that's Ooh. Just in their toolbox, ready to go.
Sorry, but you just made me think of a new segment where you come up with your locks of the week, and it's called Down Pat, because you're Pat.
Oh, God damn it, Jake. Thank you. No, that's...
This week on Down Pat. Hell yeah. Yo, hey, think of one for UFC 207.
I will do my best. I mean, although I must say I like Carl's Stone Cold Lead Pipe Lock of the Century of the Week. that is pretty hard to beat. But, yeah, it just seemed like Paige was really reacting to Michelle. Michelle was just dictating the pace. And Paige is a very, you know, very talented young prospect still. And, I mean, even when Michelle got the takedown there, Paige did very well to roll away. She was trying to sweep, trying to reverse there. But Michelle was just so quick, right on it. She adjusted, stayed on the back, and got that choke in. Just exploited that position. She had plenty of time. And my goodness, those hands, they looked very good too. Michelle was very quick. She was popping Paige with the hands. She did very well to negotiate the slight size discrepancy that she was facing there, and just a dominant performance. Yeah, it was amazing. Definitely a eye-opening performance, and really looks like a legit contender here at 115 pounds. I mean, of course, shocking. You know, to say that she would be, I mean, as you mentioned, she's the Invicta atomweight champion at 105 pounds. So, of course, she's incredibly talented women's mixed martial artist. But, yeah, looking good up at 115 pounds as well.
And I think that does it with UFC on Fox 22. It was a fun card. The card before UFC 206. Hard to top that one. That one, or UFC 199, I really think is going to end up being my card of the year when we do the TMP Awards next episode. Because, man, those two cards blew it out of the water. 199 being the card from the Forum where Bisping took out Luke Rockhold. And 206 being that recent Holloway Pettis card that all around was just fucking fun to the gills. Duho Choi vs. Cub Swanson, fight of the year. Fun fights. So I guess that's all we got with UFC on Fox 22, and we'll move from the bottom of the women's weight classes, 115, up to the top 145, like we said last episode and talked about a little bit. Holly Holm versus Jermaine de Randamie. They'll be fighting for that 145 belt. And we all kind of assumed that the winner would get Cyborg. Now that might not be the case. News coming out today that Cyborg, in her first random drug test, has been popped by USADA. She'll likely get a one-year ban. Her team has already come out with a response saying that this was prescribed by a doctor. It was a diuretic. She lost weight to get to 140, and it was very, very, very difficult for her. A doctor gave her that. And from what I've seen from experts responding to precisely what she said, is that there's a lot of sketchiness, a lot of discrepancies in what she said and what the story was with her weight cut before this failed drug test news came out. So I'm going to rule on the side that her team is probably full of shit. And, you know, I was here the last few weeks championing Chris Cyborg, saying she should get a fight. She, you know, is a hell of a fighter and will probably hold gold at featherweight. And now, you know, it just leaves you with a sour taste in your mouth. I think kind of the overall feeling between MMA fans was either duh or should have known, she's been popped before, and it's sad. You know, I assume we'll see her come back and eventually fight for the belt, but she's not exactly still a spring chicken. I think she's in her like mid 30s or something, right? She's 31, so she actually still has a little bit of time career wise. This isn't going to be damning. But, man, it sucks. You know, she's one of the best female fighters out there, and I'd like to watch her fight. So the fact that it looks like she's going to be out for a year from this potential anti-doping violation by USADA, that's a bummer.
No, it really is, and it's tough to... really, we've seen it before. It was, what, her last Strike Force fight? When she got popped, fighting the Japanese woman. I'm drawing a blank right now. Do not have the Wikipedia up. But, yeah, we've seen her pop hot. I mean, the steroid talk, it was talked about for years. But... you know, this is now her second time failing. And I want to say it has to be less than 5 years. So, I mean, yeah, she's been one of the most dominant women in the sport, but I mean, this is, just seems to be confirming a lot of the suspicions and criticisms that have been hurled her way over the years. I mean, I'm sure Ronda Rousey is somewhere just laughing happier than anybody over this. I mean, she's very skilled. She's dangerous. You know, she has good striking. She has good grappling technique. I mean, she's been in the game for a long time now. She is one of the first generation, you know, pioneer women's mixed martial artists. But when you look now, it's like, gosh, you know, how much of that is technique and how much of that is the juice, because she's always been a lot bigger than all of the girls that she's faced. So it casts even more of a shadow of doubt. Not that the first test didn't already, but I mean, you get another one here. That just does not help with the legacy overall. And especially, you know, as you mentioned, hey, if I know you were lobbying for her to get a 145-pound title shot and for a 145-pound championship to be made. And, you know, here it is. This is what happens. And it's I don't know. I feel it's going to be tough to get people behind her after this.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. She went from complaining about not getting a title fight in March, and now she probably won't get one until 2018, if that. So, disappointing news there. Speaking of PEDs, Alistair Overeem, he's going to be fighting Mark Hunt at UFC 209. Mark Hunt saying he wants there to be an anti-doping clause in the fight that... You know what? I'm going to look this up now before I look like an ass and say the wrong thing. But basically, have a clause in the contract of the fight, especially for if his opponent ends up failing a PED test after the fight. Here we go. I got the quote in front of me. Quote: "My clause will protect me in this instant and take the financial gain of the opponent of caught cheating. That deterrent will protect me and other fighters. I'm pushing for this clause. I want to fight. I'm ready. If it doesn't go ahead, it's not my doing." So, I guess he wants to get the opponent's money if they test positive, and he told his website that he'll only fight Overeem if the special provision is added to the contract. We'll see if it gets added, but that will be a fun fight, a rematch to a Dream 5 fight back in 2008 where Overeem choked Hunt out. And honestly, I think we see the same thing happen here. You know, Hunt has shown throughout his career that he can be taken down, and if you're good enough at jiu-jitsu, can be subbed. And Overeem can probably take Hunt down if he can survive, you know, the heavy, heavy hands, which I think he'll only really need to do once, and only need to take Hunt down once in the first round, and I think he'll probably be able to submit the Super Samoan. I guess this will be at UFC 209, so we're talking early 2017. I guess that would be March 4th. March 4th at the T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas. UFC 209. I hope we see both of the Diaz brothers on that card. Because it's fucking UFC 209. But who do you see winning that fight between Hunt and Overeem? I think you might be muted.
Oh, yep. Oh, there we go. So, technical difficulties there. You know, man, Mark Hunt these days, he's still on the resurgence. I don't know what it is. It's just, I feel like ever since he has come to the UFC and shored up that ground game, I mean, I don't know. He seems to have negotiated that low center of gravity. And, you know, he's been in some precarious situations. The Stefan Struve fight. My goodness, how long was he playing around in Stefan Struve's guard, just doing things that I know everybody's screaming at him, get out of there, you know, don't do that. I think he's got a solid shot. And I think, you know, I mean, Overeem is not Fabricio Verdum. Granted, Overeem has already submitted Mark Hunt once, as you mentioned, back in Dream. And he has submitted many a person, and he does have a very well-rounded game that includes his K-1 Grand Prix credentials, as well as overall mixed martial arts game and championships and multiple organizations. But, man, Mark Hunt, also a K-1 Grand Prix champion, and has really, you know, he's been hanging in there. He has gone the distance, with some very tough guys, and won a lot of fights. I mean, that I don't think, you know, 5 years ago, we didn't think Mark Hunt would win, but he's come back and he's just been destroying people, you know, a little more on off and on as of late. But then again, you could say the same about Overeem, although Overeem has been putting it together. He seems to be a little more consistent as of late. He had that skid, but he's been putting it together late. Man, I don't know. This is a tough one, but it really only takes one with Mark Hunt. Whew, hard one to call right now. I'd have to say, yeah. This, you know what? This is a coin toss for me right now. I'll really have to to delve deep into this one, because I could easily see that one going either way. I'm calling it a pick 'em at the moment.
P money pick 'em between Hunt and Overeem. Really kind of a slow week. Things usually kind of grind to a halt around the holidays and then pick back up around the new year. I think let's dive into our last topic of 2016. That's UFC 207, which will be a rare Friday card. They're obviously not going to do a Saturday night card on New Year's Eve because nobody's going to watch that. Friday card, December 30th on pay-per-view. As we usually do, let's start with the prelim fights. Actually, this is shaping out. Normally, the UFC's big cards of the year, they do the New Year card is big, the Super Bowl weekend card is big, the Memorial Day card is big, and the 4th of July card is usually the biggest of the year. This year, UFC 200, which should have been the biggest fight of the year, but a lot of things surrounding it didn't really work out. So UFC 207, the UFC's New Year card at the T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas, of course, headlined by the return of Ronda Rousey. All of the posters just saying she's back with a picture of Nunez and Rousey. The obvious bias in all the commercials for this card. I mean, do you want to talk about that for a second? Because it's hilarious that Amanda Nunez is the champion. And if you have seen any ads for this card, it's just like, Rousey, 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 the return of Ronda Rousey. Bam, bam. First minute. Like, at the very end, they put it like, and she's about Amanda Nunez. Like, Amanda Nunez is getting absolutely no play on any of these ads. Do you want to speak to that for a second before we dive into the card?
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, I'm not surprised that Ronda Rousey is getting the majority of advertising time. I mean, you would think that it'd be maybe a 2/3 split, something like that. If this is a 30-second ad, you know, that Ronda would get 20, about 20 seconds of it. But man, no, this is like you get a flash of Amanda Nunes. You would think it would help to build the card just by at least, you know, showing the body of work. Because, I mean, Amanda Nunes, man, she's been doing a lot lately. That's, you know, a lot of good things to show off there that you would think would be able to help build this. But no, Ronda Rousey, that's all it takes, man. Just put Ronda Rousey on there. Doesn't matter. She's not the champion. Just... just put her up there. She's back. I must say, at the casino slot machines, there are some local casino slots, and this is advertised everywhere on literally every single one. And on that one, it is 50-50. You know, it's Ronda's face, Amanda's face. But it does say she's back, you know.
She's Rousey's back.
Rousey's back, yeah. Oh, yeah. So no, they're banking hard, but at least, you know, visually covered equally there. But no, that Ronda machine, they are riding that one hard.
What is standing out to you on these prelims? Because I'm liking a lot of these fights. The first two fights on the card, as always on UFC Fight Pass, we got Brandon Thatch versus Nico Price. Tim Means versus Alex Oliveira. I don't know who Nico Price is, but I know the other three guys are all fucking badass welterweights, and I'm assuming Nico Price is a badass welterweight, A, because he's got a cool-ass name, and B, because he's being matched up against Brandon Thatch. So I'm just expecting a good fight here. Tim Means versus Alex Oliveira. I mean, both of these fights, you're going to see a lot of throwing. And then we move up into the Fox Sports 1 part. Antonio Carlos Jr., I believe the -135 favorite over Marvin Vettori. And then we got Alex Garcia, -160 over Mike Pyle. Dong Young Kim, -135, facing Tarek Saffanin. That'll be a very fun fight. Both of these guys, very underrated. welterweights. Johnny Hendricks and Neil Magny just about even there. Neil Magny a slight edge at -115 over Johnny, who's -105. Who, man, if he doesn't watch out, his trajectory seems to be on a downward slope. And he better bring it. You know, I think he can beat Neil Magny, but he needs to bring everything, or else Neil Magny is gonna just outpace and outlength Johnny to a decision. We'll go ahead and lump Ray Borg, Lewis Smolka in there. A flyweight fight again, pretty even on the betting line, so you can expect a back and forth fight. I'm taking Ray Borg, but Lewis Smolka, dangerous flyweight. I'm not counting him out until the fight's over, but I am taking Borg there. So I'm taking Borg, Magny, Kim, Garcia Jr., Means, and Thatch. What do you think of those fights? Who you got?
Oh boy, well this is going to be a really fun card. Definitely a solid, as you mentioned. The New Year's Eve card is one of the banner ones for the UFC, and I certainly think they did a great job. I mean, only two fights on the Fight Pass, but yeah, Brandon Thatch versus Nico Price. Not familiar with Nico Price myself, but sounds like a Grand Theft Auto character or something like that. So expect a solid scrap from that. Should be good. And I mean, Brandon Thatch always putting on a show. Tim Means, the Dirty Bird, you know that's my boy, versus Alex Cowboy Oliveira. Love Alex Oliveira myself. He's a real gamer. That's going to be dynamite. And, man, that is the Fight Pass portion of the card. Old Zapato Jr. Has a Marvin Vittori here. Mike Pyle versus the Dominican Nightmare, Alex Garcia. That'll be a good fight. Those two are always always scrapping. The Stun Gun versus Safadine, very nice fight there. A lot of welterweight action, my goodness. In the preliminary portion, only one fight in six fights, not at a welterweight, and
Jeez,
that is the,
yeah. Jesus Christ, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, that's the middleweight scrap between Zapato and Vittori, but yeah, very interesting. I mean, Johnny Hendricks versus Neil Magny, that is. Quite the headliner for the Fox Sports 1 preliminary card. Neil Magny has really only struggled against the most elite of the most elite. Johnny Hendricks was the most elite of the most elite. I mean, still has the credentials. Those credentials can never be taken away from him, but he's taken a couple lumps. Yeah,
and you and me, dude, we used to be huge Johnny Dick riders. Both of us saying, there's no way in fuck that Stephen Thompson beats him.
Stephen's going to get mollywopped.
We're both, oh my God, we were riding that Johnny D hard. And now, dude, he's been on some shaky grounds. Yeah, dude.
I thought there was no way Kelvin Gastelum
was going to be Johnny Hendricks. I know he's
you did pick Kelvin.
But that's another thing.
Yeah, I mean, he's
going to beat the fuck out of Vitor.
Oh, my goodness. You know, that'll be fun. I will enjoy that. I really am with you on that one. Kelvin over non-TRT Vitor, for sure. But, yeah, Johnny Hendricks, man, you know, he only ever had a couple L's on his record. And, you know, well, anyways, we've been down that road many times. But he's racked up a couple now, two losses in a row now, and those are legitimate, undeniable. TKO'd by Stephen Thompson, savagely in the first round. Kelvin Gastelum beat the dog piss out of him over the course of three rounds, fairly one-sidedly. Again, Neil Magny has only ever lost to the top tier. And Johnny Hendricks was always there, but now, I mean, my goodness, where is he's going? Where, you know, what direction is he's going? Neil Magny, he's got a rebound as well. I mean, he's coming off a TKO loss to Lorenz Larkin. And while Johnny Hendricks, he's got the power. He's got devastating power. But he is not the striker that Lorenz Larkin is. Lorenz Larkin is much quicker. He's got a much more technical kickboxing base. he's not going to have that same level of threat. Johnny Hendricks, I mean, again, he's putting together the good combos, but he is not someone who started from striking like Lorenz. He's a wrestler that converted to striking. And as serviceable as he is, I don't think he's going to be TKOing Neil Magny with elbows. He's also going to have a similar size discrepancy here. So I really think if Johnny wants to win this fight, it's going to have to be a wrestling-based game or, you know, just a smothering ground-and-pound type of affair. I don't know that he'll be able to get the submission over Neil Magny. I think he's just going to have to stay sticky, have to really blanket Neil Magny and get the ground-and-pound going, you know, maybe get some wall-and-stall tactics. And he's got a shot, but I mean, Magny, he's from someone who's been very, I mean, he started his UFC career 1-2, but he's just rattled off the wins. And he's been very prolific, certainly won a lot more fights. He's just gotten better and better over his tenure in the UFC. And he's got a lot of ways to do it. He's a very tall 170 pounder, got a lot of reach. He can cause some problems for Johnny. Man, that's going to be a very interesting fight there. And quite telling for old Johnny and really for both of these guys as to where they're going to fit in at the 170-pound picture.
Yeah, and go ahead and break Borg Smolka down for us. I decided to lump that
flyweight yes. fight. Yes. Oh yeah. I mean, you know what? That one's a very close one as well. I mean, Smolka and Borg, they both.
I'm picking Borg, but it's close, man. I don't know who to take there. Style wise, it's tough to gauge.
No, I mean it's a tough. It's just a tough matchup. I mean, they've also both kind of been up and down. You know me. I like to look a lot at, I like to look at the fighting styles to see how they match up, but also the momentum a lot. And Smolka and Borg have both kind of been inconsistent. Borg has kind of been on the downward side. I want to say he like 1-2, lost 2. Smolka, I want to say he just won a fight. No, just lost a fight actually a couple months ago.
Yeah. So, yeah. Speaking of trajectory, it's funny. They're both at the exact same place. Borg is 9-2, Smolka 11-2. Both of them won a gang of fights, got into the UFC, then lost early on, then won 3 or 4, and then lost. And this is their first fight after the second loss. Borg's most recent fight, a loss, a decision to Justin Scoggins. Smolka getting choked out by Brandon Moreno this past October.
Yeah. So it's to me, those are always the most or some of the more difficult fights to judge. You know, who's going to show up? You know, is this going to be which version of which fighter is going to show up? Is this going to be, you know, the last samurai that we've seen, you know, put together those good combos and use his really long reach for the flyweight division? Or, you know, is this going to be Ray Borg who's shown that ground wizardry and just wrapping people up? Tough fight to call. Definitely a good one. Both very solid 125 pounders. Right now, I don't know what it is for some reason. You know what? I think I got to lean Borg as well. Borg is crafty. We just saw The Last Samurai get submitted, and Ray Borg is a threat, man. You do not want to fight that guy if the ground game is lacking. So, yeah, I think I'm leaning Borg on this one myself.
Another thing that makes it a little tricky to gauge, both of them have a combined 14 fights combined in the UFC's flyweight division, so you'd assume that they've had some similar opponents, but neither one has fought the same man in Borg's 11 fight and Smolka's 13 fight career. So hard to work any MMA math in there. Moving up, we got TJ Dillashaw and John Lineker. This is this is all Styles 2 to me, and every time we see, like, a patient, well-rounded kickboxer go up against a guy who throws heavy as fuck and can land super hard, I feel like the former always wins. You always see the guy who's really good at timing and keeping distance and kicking and leg kicking and throwing counters and protecting himself against the big punch. Look, I think John Lineker is a motherfucker. I think he's easily a top five guy there at bantamweight. I would love to see him fight like a Jimmy Rivera or something. But right now, I think Cruz is at, you know, this crazy elite top level, and the only one really close to where he is Dillashaw. You know, their fight was close as nails. I'd really like to see them fight again. I think we will see that if both of them win here at UFC 207. And not to give away my hand too much, but I think that will be the case. So here I'm picking TJ Dillashaw, who in the books is at, well, wow, actually, moderately big favorite of minus 250. Vegas doesn't think much of John Lineker, I guess. But, yeah, I'm also going to go with TJ Dillashaw here. Who you got?
Man, this is a nuts fight. John Lineker is just a Tasmanian devil at 135 as well as 125 pounds. He's shown that his power does move up to bantamweight, and he's been putting on people, really. And we've seen Dillashaw susceptible to the heavy hands, but it's been a long time since John Dodson handed him his first UFC loss by TKO some time ago at the Tough Finale. Since then, I mean, this is a completely, absolutely different TJ Dillashaw. But, man, I just don't know if you can avoid as good of a tactician and as good of the footwork and just the style that TJ Dillashaw has developed. Can you avoid John Lineker for that long? I mean, this is only a 15-minute fight, and John Lineker, he's not shy about getting in there. He'll take one. He'll bite down on the mouthpiece. Almost every fight we see John Lineker in, there's some crazy exchange where it's just two guys just wailing the shit out of each other. And usually John Lineker comes out on top. Because he's got a chin, and he's got crazy. I mean, he's a guy that called Hands of Stone that actually has the Hands of Stone and puts people out. Dillashaw does not want any part of that. He's got to stay on that bike for all 15 minutes. Man, it's a tough one. You know, I think I'm with you though, Jake. I think I'm gonna have to go with Dillashaw on this one. I think he will. He's just got the height and reach as well. He's got such a variety in his arsenal. He's got the wrestling. He's got a lot of tools. I think he'll be able to get it done, but man, it's a dangerous opponent in John Lineker.
And bumping up one, we will get to Cruz Garbrandt after that, but Cain Velasquez versus Fabricio Werdum, the rematch and likely the title eliminator fight at heavyweight. The first time around, Fabricio Werdum took the belt from Cain. It was in Mexico City, 2 miles up, and Cain just went up there fight week while Fabricio went there, I think, like, 3 months beforehand to train. And Cain definitely suffered from cardio issues, seemingly having to do with the lack of oxygen up 2 miles high in Mexico City. This is another fight where I'm picking the favorite, and I'm surprised Vegas sees him as favorite this much. Cain's minus 200 in Vegas. So I don't know if I would necessarily bet on him. but at the same time, I think come December, even though there have been rumors of injuries, I think he takes it to Fabricio. And, like, honestly, I think Cain is Man, he is underrated so much, and it's a shame that he gets injured so often in seemingly the foolish weightlifting conditions that AKA puts their guys through. But Kane is a fucking animal. I think he's one of the greatest fighters of all time. And I think he wins this fight, and I think he beats Stipe, too. I think he's going to get the belt back. who do you have in this one, brother?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, as
that
I was...
That take was hot.
That was a very hot take, sir. Be prepared, because, you know, I had some thoughts. I had some takes on this one myself, you know. Really, this fight here, you know me, Jake. And those that listen closely, they know too. I say, look out for these rematches. The rematches where the guy who beat the other guy is the betting underdog. More often than not, that is a safe bet. I think, what was the last time I called it for? The Jim Miller, Joe Lozon rematch. I think Jim Miller was an underdog in that one. I forget, but, this is one of those situations. You got Fabricio Werdum. He's almost a minus or a plus 200 underdog here to Cain Velasquez. And he beat the piss out of Cain Velasquez the first time in Mexico at altitude. Sure. I'm not really buying that whole argument. So, okay, you take away altitude. Now they're fighting in Vegas. What is the difference? They're still fighting in the same atmospheric conditions. I mean, really, that's ultimately
I for
what
sure
it comes
buy
down
it.
To.
I not only buy it, I predicted that was going to be a huge difference, that Werdum had taken time to fully acclimatize. I don't know what the word is.
Acclimatize
to get used to the elevation, where Cain was at sea level and then flew up. And, you know, the term sea level Cain has kind of turned into a joke with the MMA community, but I think it's a very real thing. And I think, like, I predicted that would be a huge, huge difference. I mean, even going to Denver, which is a mile up, you feel it. And when you go up, and when you go up two miles, it like works like exponentially. So it's not just like two times as worse. It's like four times worse. Literally the oxygen that you can pull out of the air when you're 2 miles high is like half of what you can when you're at sea level. So when you're doing cardio and you're working out and you're getting used to your lungs strengthening, whereas in California you're not doing that. Like I think people are maybe too quick to call things an excuse, because the way I see it, that was just them giving a logical reason. Like, no, like we're not like an excuse would be, you know, something that sheds them of blame. But saying that they weren't, you know, ready enough, that's still accepting blame. You know, that's saying we should have done this better. And this fight will be in Vegas, so you're not quite a mile high, but I think you're a good 4,000 feet. But I'm sure Kane will be ready this time around, and I'm picking him for sure.
No, yeah, no, it's not day FA for sure. Granted, Las Vegas is not sea level, but it's not going to be the most extreme. My point is, especially with, if we're going back to that first fight, this isn't like Chad Mendes versus Conor McGregor, where Chad Mendes took the fight short notice. You know, if we want to talk about ill preparation, being ill prepared,
sounds like a rap band. Ill preparation.
Ill. Thank you. I'm going to write that down. Got a new side project going to work on. But no, in that fight, Chad Mendes was looking good against Conor McGregor and having a good degree of success working the takedowns. I mean, that he was doing quite well in that fight. In their first fight, there was absolutely no point where Cain Velasquez was doing well. He was getting beat from stem to stern, standing to the point where in between rounds two and three, his corner was suggesting that they take down Fabricio Werdum, one of the most decorated Brazilian jiu-jitsu grapplers to ever grace the UFC, and he was submitted very quickly. There was just really the only good thing that he did was complete the takedown, but that led him right into a guillotine choke. Really the only, I don't know, it's tough. He's fighting a much taller Fabricio Werdum. Fabricio throws much more a varied attack with the legs, with the hands. He doesn't care if he goes down to the ground or gets taken down because he is just going to wrap you up. Sure, now Cain Velasquez, he has some of the most absolutely fearsome ground and pound in the UFC, in any division. I mean, he is just an absolute nightmare with that ground and pound. I still see some of the things he's done to his opponents in my head when I close my eyes, but you don't want to go to the ground with Fabricio Werdum.
It's
scary stuff, man. What are you going to do? So you've got a guy who's significantly taller than you, who has a much more diverse striking arsenal. He's already beat you one time before. This is just one of those instances where I don't see anything different. I mean, so now they're at Las Vegas. Now all things are being equal. But again, you know, people want to say, well, you know, the sea level thing, or, you know, being at elevation. Again, it's not like Cain started strong for the first, you know, couple minutes or anything like that. He really never got going. I don't know. This is a fight where Fabricio Werdum, he had that loss to Stipe. He got knocked out by Stipe, but he came back against Travis Brown. He had that get-right fight, and, man, he looked good against Travis Brown. He put it on him. Certainly didn't look any slower, any worse for the wear. Didn't seem to suffer any kind of hesitancy. So he's already overcame one mental hurdle as well in suffering that setback to Stipe Miocic. It's not like, you know, he's coming in to fight Cain Velasquez, you know, trying to get another win. Now, he's already won. He's already got the momentum going in the right direction. Now, he's trying to keep it that way against a guy he's already beat. Granted, I can see Cain Velasquez doing it. I can see Cain Velasquez beating the piss out of anybody on the planet Earth. That's not a problem. I can picture that, absolutely. But, man, you already lost to Fabricio. It's hard, man. I think I'm actually riding with Fabricio in this one as my stack and chips pick for UFC 207. Got Fabricio with the repeat.
Oh, yeah. Which rolls us to the co-main, Cody Garbrandt and Dominic Cruz. For me, in the line here is Cruz minus 220, which is a close line to Cain, when I am way, way, way more confident in Dominic Cruz than I am in Cain Velasquez. Cruz is a legend of the sport, the footwork on point, the hands on point. And I know there have been times in the past where I'm super confident and the fight does not go the way I expected it to. But I would be shocked. I would be absolutely floored if Cody Garbrandt was able to land a power punch and finish Dominic Cruz. Cruz has lost once in his entire career and avenged that loss twice. He gave Mighty Mouse his only loss. The guy is a killer. The guy had some injury, terrible luck in the prime of his career, and he's roared back and looked just as good as he did before the injuries. I have Cruz, no pun intended, cruising to a win here. I think it's a decision, though. I don't think he finishes Garbrandt. So I have it like 49-46 Cruz.
Yeah, I'd say I'd see it fairly similarly in this one. I mean, Cody Garbrandt definitely has a chance. He has put away people that just don't get put away at the bantamweight division. He's got solid hands out there with Team Alpha Male, great camp. But this is just Dominic Cruz. He's one of the best to ever do it. And he's just a ring tactician, a true master in there. And it's going to be quite tough, as you mentioned, just for him to land that punch cleanly. Dominic Cruz just doesn't seem to move in a way that allows him to ever get punched cleanly.
And we got Pickles in the background seeming to agree with B-Money.
Yes, I mean, everybody knows Dominic Cruz. He's going to come in and, he's going to get it done. I mean, he showed some good stuff in his last fight against Uriah Faber in the ceiling of that trilogy, dropping Uriah Faber in the first round. He just seems to be getting better and better himself. Dominic Cruz. Although, I mean, Cody Garbrandt, he's young. He's a dangerous threat. He's got neck tattoos. I mean, you know, he's very threatening. But
he used to date Paige.
Used to date Paige. But Dominic, he's just. I think he's still in his prime. He's still doing it, and I think he retains by decision here as well. Although I would not be surprised by a late TKO even.
Yeah, I think Cruz has registered a couple of those in his career. in this final fight, Ronda Rousey and Amanda Nunes, or Nunez, depending on how you want to pronounce it, now on a 4-fight winning streak, looking for her first title defense after rear naked choking Miesha Tate in the first round back in the main event of UFC 200. Man, you know, I really do like Amanda Nunes a lot. I think I think not only is she great now, I think she has room to grow and will probably keep getting better. You know, she's only 28 years old. She was born in 88, so she's going to be around for the next several years. And when Ronda Rousey leaves and retires, which I assume, you know, we'll see Rousey probably leave the sport before Amanda does. After Rousey leaves, I could see Amanda being, you know, next in line and truly the best bantamweight fighter in the world. But Ronda Rousey, man, I know she just got finished by Holm, but the way she dominated that division, she's the greatest women's fighter of all time, and it's hard to pick against her. I have her winning the fight with a first round armbar. I think a lot of people are over critiquing her mental state, and to me, you know, she definitely looked like she was wigging out after she got knocked out, but the last, you know, few months her training for this fight, she's looked nothing but ready and confident, and I definitely think she could get a lot better too if she switched camps. But we've had that discussion on this show before too. I'm taking Rousey, and honestly, at minus 135, man, if I did bet this sport more often than like once or twice a year, I'd probably put a ton of money on Ronda Rousey. I'd put at least $50 on Rousey because I really like that line, minus 135. You know, I think she should be up at like minus 250, honestly, because Rousey has not only put away some of the best women in the world, but put them away decidedly. So I got Rousey here. Pat, final chance of 2016 to drop hot takes for Santa Claus, who's going to be rolling down the chimney here in about 48 hours on the East Coast. Give him a good holiday hot take to take into 2017.
Oh man, I want to give him something good, Jake. You know, I was really feeling the upset here. I mean, we've seen the women's bantamweight championship belt just being passed around, doing the hot potato thing since Ronda Rousey.
Holm, Tate, Nunes.
Since, I mean, logic would think it's just going to keep hot potato until it lands on Rousey again, and she's just going to hold on to it, take that thing and run with it. you know, oh, Rousey just, you know, ran into the one chick, that one style matchup. You know, everybody's got that one style matchup that they don't want to go up against. Perhaps Holly Holm is that for her, because certainly there has not been another female in mixed martial arts that has even begun to look the part of a challenge for Ronda Rousey. It's kind of the Anderson Silva thing in this as well for me, where I feel like I kind of have to go with Ronda. I mean, yeah, we saw her lose to Holly, but I'm not believing it until I see it again. We saw so much dominance. And Amanda Nunes, she is a beast of a competitor. But I just feel that, oh my goodness, I don't know. As far as the striking goes, I feel like the striking would just help play to Ronda's judo game. You know, Amanda Nunes, as good as she is, she relies, I'd say, more so on the power shots. She's a very powerful striker. You know, not a world champion, one of the best female boxers that there's ever been. So I believe, like many of the other women that Ronda Rousey has faced, she's going to exploit that hole somewhere, be it in the stand-up, be it on the ground. Amanda Nunes, she's very good on the ground herself, very powerful. I think that's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out, because Ronda Rousey is one of the best female grapplers in MMA. I mean, look at what she did to Sarah McMahon. Look at what she did to Misha Tate. You know, look at what Misha Tate did to Sarah McMahon. I mean, Sarah McMahon was a women's Olympic silver medalist in wrestling. The grappling credentials are so deep there. Man, this, I'd love to give him an upset, but you know, I think I got to go with Rousey in this one as well. She's just, she has just been that force for so long, even as bad as she lost in her last match. And as good as Amanda has looked in her last four matches, I think Ronda's going to get this one.
We're both going Ronda Rousey here. And wow, as I choke on my own spit to wrap up the new year, we do thank you for tuning in to the MMA podcast, the 192nd edition. We're also going to try and start this new thing out where if you want to call us anytime during the week, the phone number is the same, 213-457-3380. Call us and just leave us a voicemail. Leave us a hot take, and we will play it on the air, whether it's just a hot take or a comment or a question, anything like that. We will hear you out, play it on the podcast. And aside from that, Pat, you have any holiday wishes for the people before we put a bow on it, put it under the tree, and wish the listeners not only a Merry Christmas but a Happy New Year.
Yes. Well, I'd like to wish you, Jake, especially, and all the listeners a happy and merry and safe holidays with your loved ones, with your friends. You know, hopefully you're safe and whatever you do.
Background music.
Peace on earth. Goodwill towards men. God bless us, every one of us. And looking forward to bringing you all the best, hottest takes in the MMA and fighting game in 2017.
Hell yeah. Have an awesome one wherever you are. We're all a big, big family here. Whether you're seeing family, chilling on your own. We appreciate the listen. Follow us at the MMA podcast. This was not a live show, unfortunately, because we're doing it on the road, but we do try and do most of them live, try and take calls. So we love to do that. And, man, I'm feeling the need to go a little verbose here because it's the last show of the year, but I just, like I've said a million times, I'm overwhelmed by all the support and all the listenership and all the friends we've made along the way. So I'm looking forward to 2017. Until then, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, enjoy UFC 207, and we'll see you in 2017. We gone.